You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedian's Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm talking to a human smoking jacket of a man, the wonderful drunk professor archetype that is Tom Tuck. You'll know him from the Penny Dreadfuls. You'll know him from his own solo work. Tom Tuck goes straight to DVD and other shows besides The Square Root of Minus One, we talk about, and also the one in the middle, the name of which temporarily escapes me. Tom is an excellent actor, a very fine comic actor, and a really interesting and unusual stand-up comedian. We're also going to talk about the Alternative Comedy Memorial Society, of whom he's a founding member, and there's plenty to talk about, so let's get stuck straight in. This is Tom Tuck.
Last night I was trying to look up a quote and get the exact thing of a quote from a review from ages ago.
Yes.
And so I read through the whole review and I thought you'd like
that. Quote. Tuck is very adept at noticing stuff. From no less hallowed a publication than Fringe Review.
Yeah,
well done.
That wasn't the quote I was actually trying to look up. There was, I think it was innately solipsistic.
Wow. Okay. Solipsistic is given to self-reflection, is that
yes,
right?
Correct, yeah.
Yes. Gotcha.
And my partner went, hang on, Tom, you're Googling your own name and the word solipsistic.
That is, that's really beautiful. That's great. We didn't see much of each other at Edinburgh last year.
Exactly, yeah. So
you were doing your secret underground, under the radar.
Which I'm really annoyed at the night you came wasn't quite a massive... It didn't kick off quite the same way. Because
okay.
I mean, you saw the structure of the show.
Yes.
But,
it was very funny.
I mean, it's sort of... If I'm slightly off form, that show doesn't work the way it can do.
Ah.
And because of the structure of speaking to someone.
Yes.
Everything. And I have to go with the things. I can't ignore anything.
Completely. This is the section of the show where you're asking...
The whole show is that.
Yeah, it is. It's not... Oh, is it all? No, I mean, you did come back to certain kind of points within it that were the show outside of that conversation. We should explain what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
You ask people to describe themselves with the words, I am.
I am X, where X is a variable and has to be about yourself. And it could be anything.
There's certain things you don't allow, like you don't allow temporary states, is that
yes,
right?
Yes, and that the whole bit about language, the word to be in English is quite a big word. It's not got many letters in it, but it's quite a big word. But in Spanish, they have ser and estar.
Yes. Oh, so, meaning I am, and I
am
always.
Yes, so yes. Estoy borracho. I am drunk.
Yes.
Soy borracho. I am always drunk. And that may well be true. We are after permanent states. So, yeah, getting people to say something about themselves.
Yes.
And then from that, I'd spin off either a routine I'd already written... For the show, a routine I improvised, or a routine from an old show, if it was precisely the right thing to do.
Yes.
In that situation. And then the sort of the clincher of the show was I was saying things about me. And that was the sort of spine about my biological father.
Yes. Now, this show, there's loads of things to talk about. I'm sort of wondering where to come in on this. The burning issue... I have about your show is I thought to myself, bloody hell, is Tuck doing a below-the-radar show, which he will then do at Edinburgh next year, and it will be an eligible, nominatable show because it hasn't been on the Fringe before, despite you having run it in at the Fringe?
No, I have no... I don't give a fuck about the awards anymore.
But are you planning to do that? Are you planning to do that show? Was that like
no.
a practice show?
No,
was that was the whole of your Fringe experience? Because
yeah.
I love that. You were handing out flyers that you'd
Yeah, I didn't go in the Fringe Guide and handmade every single flyer myself. And so it was just my tweeting, my handmade flyers, and the Free Fringe guy brought some people in.
I have to say, looking at my pile of flyers that was all over my table, when in the situation that we're all familiar with, when you've got far less time at the Fringe than you thought you had,
the bedside
and you
table. Stuff,
the bedside table effect. Much as I was planning to see your show anyway, and I've seen or heard all of your shows, I'm just tripping myself up there. Can I be caught out? All of your shows? I think all of your shows. But the fact of a handmade flyer made me go, oh, I mean, it's hand. I've got to see this one. I've got to track this one down. That's a great tactic.
Well, that's the Fringe. You've got to look at what the edges are in any situation, any system. You've got to see what the things... Come on, coffee, start working. In any system, the point of interest is where the information is narrowed.
Yes, okay.
You see what I mean? For instance, I was talking to my flatmate last night about art, and she was saying about Damien Hirst's piece of work. She said, that stupid shark thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, no. The reason it's a great piece of art is because where the information is narrowed, where the art is in that piece of art is the title of it, mm-hmm. The Impossibility of Death in the Mind of Something Living.
Mm-hmm.
And then having to think about that title whilst being shown this thing. That's where the information is narrowed, and that's where the systems... God, I'm already getting too pretentious.
No, stick with it. I want to know what you mean.
So, there are the rules to doing the Fringe.
Yes.
You get flyers made.
Yes.
You get posters made. You go in the Fringe programme. Now, that's the system of the Fringe. The system of audience at the Fringe is a different system, where you can narrow the information and give someone a handmade flyer.
Yes.
You are bypassing all of that other stuff and giving them a guilt trip.
Okay, yeah.
In every situation, I think you've got to, and this is not comedy, this is comedy, this is in every situation, you've got to examine what the systems are.
Yes, now is what you're talking about simply going the opposite direction to everyone else?
No, sometimes the systems are correct.
Okay, well, I'm thinking of the things that throws up for me is I remember a few years ago, Ben Tarjay had a poster with no information on it.
Yes, exactly.
At all, including his face, everything. Yeah. Brilliant, because you saw it, you went, what's that? And then when you got a flyer a few days later, oh, that's that, and it makes a bit more... Now, that to me is a... That's like a... I wouldn't say a gimmick, but I don't know about the information being narrowed. To me, that's just like, let's take the existing thing and fuck with the system and do something different. Is that what you mean, or is it something different? Have I misunderstood?
I suppose it can be, but it's. I suppose the information, the word information there I've used is misleading. I don't mean actually the information about the show. I mean any information flow. If you meant the two humans are separate systems, and the information flow between us goes through the medium of language, which is a narrowing of information.
Okay.
Because there's all the things you can possibly think. Can't be you can't say all of them.
Okay.
To another person, if you imagine two balloons.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Two balloons connected by a straw.
Uh-huh.
It's where the information narrows. That's where you need to look at, and
that's
where the interest lies.
Okay, so you're talking. It's almost like the semiotics of the way people communicate with each other. You're going. Okay, that's a narrow stream of information.
Yeah.
So you get to affect that by using everyone at Edinburgh. Has a similarly narrow stream of information between them and their audience, and they do a particular set of conventions.
But there isn't within a narrow stream, because it's in the Fringe Guide, which is a massively wide stream.
Okay.
Do you see what
I do see. I feel what you mean. Let's come back to this, because I don't want to... I feel like we could pick anything. You and I, we're friends, we like having conversations. We could pick anything, and we could explore it indefinitely.
Yep.
There's loads and loads to talk about, so let's come back to this. But let's talk about the origins of the Penny Dreadfuls then. Mm-hmm. That you are... David and Humph, were they both doing everything and throwing themselves at theatre in that kind of way?
No. No.
So when did you first decide...
Dave did a fair bit of acting. Humph did a bit when he could be convinced to. When Dave and I could convince him to do things.
Okay.
With Jamie, wasn't at Edinburgh, Jamie was at, I think, Queen Margaret or Napier. one of the other places doing sound engineering, I think.
Okay.
But he was in Improverts with us.
Okay.
But when we all graduated, none of us had anything else to do. So we all just stayed in Edinburgh.
Mm-hmm.
I got a job. Yeah, I didn't need to.
The other two didn't need to.
Yeah.
That's a valid thing to talk about. And I am a big, like, not other people's financial situations, but it's definitely the case that people, I think there is a line to be drawn between, there's a connection to be made, rather, between some people who are creative and who have the time to be creative because they don't need to be working some bullshit job they don't want to do.
Yeah. But sort of during that year, we wrote our first Edinburgh show.
Okay.
And we took the Fringe a bit by storm because everyone was like, who are these guys? Because we'd never done a show in London.
Yes,
we were just
right.
Like, we'll be funny.
Yes, okay.
It'll be fine.
Okay.
And we were, and it was.
And so the Penny Dreadfuls was originally the, in the first iteration that I saw, which was in the Underbelly.
So it was either first or second.
So it was the first or the second. In fact, were you running around naked, being an invisible man?
No, that
naked?
Was Jamie.
That was Jamie.
So it was the
yes.
second year.
So it was the second year. That was the first. Yes, and I remember seeing it, thinking, I've heard a lot about these guys. Who are they supposed to be? Because that would have been like the second year backlash of in the first year, everyone banged on how great you were. And so the,
that was a pretty good show.
It was a great show. No, it was a great show. But I was watching it thinking. I think I went into it having been told how great you were and feeling a bit annoyed that I hadn't known who you were.
Mm.
Do you know what I mean? That's kind of second year thing. But so it says more about me.
No, I think that's very, very true.
Yes.
No, just in general of like it, the hype that you miss things.
Yeah.
And well, yeah, can't be that good.
Yeah, absolutely.
Can't be that good if I didn't see it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, when Fight Club came into the cinema, too many people were talking about it, so I didn't go watch
exactly.
it.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely. So you did the first year, and what Penny Dreadfuls was, for people, just describe it for people who
it was a sketch show cynically set in Victorian London.
Cynically?
We had seen everything that was going on with sketches, and we wanted something that would mark us out, something that would give us some, you know, cohesion, marketing wise.
Yeah.
Enabled us to look pretty sharp.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing was that we wanted to, we didn't want to do stuff, when we came down and did like little gigs in London, we didn't want to be like all the other sketch we saw in London, which our term was, ooh, it's a bit London.
Yes, okay.
And that for us meant no commitment to character.
Okay,
and it's like you've got to be the Boosh to be able to the kind of the base character's got to be so good.
Yes,
to not actually do the characters well.
Yes, that's a really interesting observation. Yes, because with the Howard and Vince, those characters, we know who they are. So when they half do something, we know it's their... It's
or more
the
than wise.
Yes.
You know, like, you've got the base level. And everyone who we saw in London were doing sketches where the sketch was like an all right idea, but they just... The characters were nothing. And then the base level, well, they hadn't done anything base level to tell us who they were.
Yes.
So it was nothing of either camp. Trying to think. And yeah, so we just wanted to do... And the Victorianness of it allowed you to go even bigger and more cartoony because everyone's yes. got a certain amount of lexicon for Victorian London anyway.
Sure.
If you
sure.
say, Captain, there's a problem here. You know, we already know what, you know, 50% of what's going on.
Yeah,
you
yeah,
don't
yeah,
have to
yeah.
do the rest of the exposition.
And how much work, like when you did that first hour, the first time you did it as part of the Fringe, how many times had you done it before? Like, were you previewing? Were you
yeah,
doing sketches at regular nights? You know, it was all fairly tightly done. Because it is partly the costume, I think, and partly, as you said, the, you know, the Victorianness of it.
And very, very much Neil's lighting and Neil's music really,
oh, yes.
really pushes it into a production.
Production values, mm. yeah, absolutely.
And there were it's cheap production values because all it is floor lights and some bombastic music. But
yes,
so well chosen.
Suddenly,
so
it takes
well
us
done.
Out of
yeah,
yeah.
We had previewed, the first show we did was probably in November the year before, so November 2005, at Bedlam. And it had a full plot, it wasn't just a sketch show.
Yes, yes.
And that's the show was called Aeneas Faversham. And the plot was about this detective or adventurer or something called Aeneas Faversham. And he was just shit, so we just cut him. So we just wrote more sketches.
Yes.
Which is a pity, because there was one bit that I... was sort of a clown bit that I did write that was in that show that just then didn't have a place without a plot. It was just, you know, trying to fill a jug with water, basically, and someone moving the jug and someone moving the glass, and the two never being in the same place whilst having a conversation.
Okay.
Which was fun, but then had to go, by the way, so, because it didn't fit the thing. And because the first sketch show was successful, we then did another one.
Yes.
And in the third year, we chose to write a play.
Yes.
Ha-ha.
Was that harder?
That's what got us disqualified from the shortlist.
Yes. Well, let's talk about this. This is the year. Which year was that?
2008.
And is this the one when we all won the panel prize? Because I remember hearing, I don't know if you've heard this or if it's purely rumour-mongering, but I remember hearing that year when we all won the panel prize, you know, when they gave the panel prize.
Yeah, I'm not
to
sure
everybody.
If that was the same year or not.
No, I don't think it was. I think it was later than that. But I remember hearing that the reason we all won the panel prize was that the judges had spent so long deliberating as to whether or not you were eligible.
Oh, that might be the case then,
For the main award. Yes.
Yes.
So that was you. You were ineligible for the, what was it those in those days? Was it the Fosters? It wasn't the Perry anymore, was it? It was the Edinburgh Edcom?
I think it was the first year of Foster, because Russell Kane won it. No, Russell Kane won it year before.
Okay.
I think it was, and so the previous year Brendan had won it when it was if.com. So yeah, it was Foster's.
Okay. And you had a banging sellout show, brilliant reviews.
We sold out every single ticket in a 170 seater of every single night. And we snuck 10 people in a night sitting on the aisles.
Yeah.
And was still the best show we've ever done.
And you didn't get nominated. You were ineligible for nomination.
Yeah, they Nika rang Idle the morning of the nominations.
Yes.
And said, "I'm really sorry, you were on the shortlist at 10 this morning. You're not on the shortlist now." So if you go on Wikipedia, there are 4 nominations that year instead of 5.
Yes. How did that feel?
We were quite bitter about it, but we ran into Kitson, who I didn't know yet. But the other two did, because they'd been playing football with him. Ran into Kitson, and he went, "Is it true?" I went, "Yeah." "It's almost as if it's a complete pile of bullshit in the first place." I was like, yeah. And Nika then put us on in the West End run.
Really?
As a double bill with Russell Kane.
Okay.
Because Russell hadn't won yet, so he was nominated.
Okay.
In a double bill with Russell Kane in a West End theatre, even though we weren't nominated.
So that must... obviously what Daniel says is sort of... it reminds you that the whole thing's sort of bullshit. But it must have... Like, were you all of one mind on that? Did it cause any kind of rifts within the group? Was anyone...
Not at all.
Not rifts, but was anyone more angry or more sanguine than anyone else? Or were you all just gutted?
We were all just a bit gutted.
Do you think now that it would have changed the course of your career?
I don't think so. Because we'd done one series of our radio show. We already had another one booked in. Maybe we'd have got telly.
You must have thought maybe, like, the radio... I mean, the radio series is brilliant. I illegally downloaded all of it. And while I can't officially recommend people do that, use your wilds.
Is it legally available? I'm not sure it is.
I don't know.
I don't think the series is legally
Someone
available.
Someone sent
fill
me
your boots, guys. Fill your boots.
Yeah.
Buy the plays, because they are legally available.
Oh, great. Yeah, okay.
You can buy those.
Which are...
Guy Fawkes.
Yes.
French Revolution.
Yes.
Hero with the Wake. And the latest one we've done is Macbeth, but that's...
And where can I buy those?
iTunes, I think, and
okay,
other places.
Okay, right. Well, I'm in. But I felt like listening to that, and I listened to the series. They come up on shuffle, and I can't fast forward through them, so I've listened to all of them many times. And they are so good. They're so funny. The performances are so good. The plots are so funny. The jokes are great. You do that lovely, like, there's so many different types of jokes. I wanted to see the TV show. You must have wanted to do the TV show.
Yeah, the problem is it's expensive.
Yes.
Because we're not, it's not modern day.
Yes.
And it's adventure.
Yes, of course.
So, it's a
Why does adventure make it more? I understand the modern day.
You know, sword fights and
stunts,
explosions. And da-da-da. Okay. Like, so the bar that you have to jump is higher for people to sort of take that risk.
Yes.
Whereas if how we were being funny was three blokes in a featureless room,
yes,
then we probably would have done telly.
Yes.
But it's about four times more expensive, so four times more than Brit, you know.
Knowing that now, if you knew that at the time, would you have gone, hang on, lads, the Victoriana thing's a good thing for marketing, but maybe we should look further ahead?
Don't know. I mean, that's just like counterfactuals, isn't it?
It's would
we have been as successful had we not had
yes,
that, you know,
yes, so. Yes. I think I would be. I'd be still carrying that around with me if I were you. It was so good. Will you do more? Will you do more Penny Dreadful stuff? Because I know you came back and you ditched all the Victoriana stuff.
Well,
it was
so
like
the next one
with Mr. Princess and all the rest.
No, there was a show in between.
Yes, there was.
But we did another play deliberately.
Was that something about oysters? Why do I think oysters?
Beef.
What was it called?
Beef Island.
Beef Island.
Don't let the beef bugs beef. and we cut so much out of that show.
That had a little mini show within a show, didn't it? Did that have like a little shadow puppet?
No, that was the 2008.
Oh, that was it. Okay,
yeah,
right.
Yeah. That 2008 one. That was a show, wasn't it?
God.
So yeah, the 2009 we did another play that was a sort of prisoner riff.
Yes.
Essentially.
Yes.
And. Then the next year we did a big show because we finally moved up from Pleasance 2. We had done 2 years in Pleasance 2 and sold every ticket of the run. And so they were like, guys, you have to go up to the biggest room. So we went to Pleasance 1, which was, you know, it's a big blowing room.
Yeah.
So we're like, we've got to do something big, silly. It's big and silly. Not expensive, but big.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, that's why the block colours and the... You know, the big, big characters and the silliness. And so that was, yeah, back to do it. And that was actually our attempt to say, hey, we can do a sketch show. This is all set modern. So,
yes.
Come on, guys. Didn't make any difference. So.
Which guys were you talking to there? The
media, you know.
The nominations people, panel. No,
we didn't give a toss about them. Absolutely not.
But you were trying to say to the world of TV, look, hey, guys, can do other genres.
Yeah.
And what was their reaction?
That pause.
What was that? You feel like did you feel that in their eyes you'd missed the boat, that they'd kind of been excited about
exciting,
the one thing,
possibly.
And you weren't exciting anymore? Yeah. It's criminal, man. So the next thing, I guess, was that you then each of you did a solo show.
Yeah, I was going to do one anyway. Even if we'd done if we'd done another dreadful show, I was always going to do a solo show. Because I'd been doing stuff alongside Dreadfuls the whole time. Like I would do a play as well, or do another, you know, bits of stand up here and there. So I was always going to do another show. But then we decided that we weren't going to do another dreadful show. So then the other two said, "Well, there's a gap in the diary, so we'll do shows as well."
So Hump did his show about his Dimmock Watson Nazi Smasher.
Yes,
and you did go straight to DVD.
Yep.
And David's show was called Shamble House.
Shamble House.
I saw all of them. Mm-hmm. I loved all of them. I'd say my favourite moment in David's show was halfway through, where he stopped and looked at the audience and said, "Have you worked it out yet? Have you worked out which one is the murderer?" Oh, you should have been doing that all the whole time. I didn't mention it at all. It was such a good joke. But Look, absolutely. Let's focus on yours, because let's not forget, of course, that some months before that show, I had given you some terrible advice.
We were in the Green Man, weren't we?
One of Sandling's gigs.
No, his birthday party.
Oh, yeah, it was. Yes, yes.
Hence why you were so drunk.
I don't think I was that drunk. I think you were
drunk enough to put your arm around me.
That's not drunk at all. I put my arm around you now.
Maybe I'm misremembering, but I think you're quite sided up.
I think you are being overly forgiving of how condescending. I'm thinking, Stuart must have been drunk. I don't think I was that. I was probably a bit drunk. You were talking about wanting to do stand. You were starting to do stand-up, and you were saying, I'm going to take an hour up to the Fringe, and I was saying, no, Tom. Just take a couple of years, get really good, because you only get to be new once. And then you turned up and got nominated.
Yeah.
Yeah, well done. Excellent work. Let this be a lesson to everyone that emails me asking for advice. I don't know what the hell I'm talking about.
I had been doing comedy a lot.
Yes.
And my first stand-up gig was in 2002. Uh-huh. So, 2011... nominated Best Newcomer in my 10th consecutive year at the Fringe.
Sure, but you know the difference. I mean, you weren't a club stand-up, you weren't doing the circuit.
No, but I knew I could do the Fringe.
Yes. So were you doing lots of gigs outside of the Fringe as warm-ups for that?
No.
Were you wrote an hour as a show, as a finished show, just for one person?
No, how it came up is, do you know Lisa Keddy?
Yes, I do, yes. Yeah.
So Keddy was doing £5 Fringe at GRV.
Yes.
In 2009, I think it was. Probably. Maybe two.
Sounds right.
And she was doing a secret show at midnight every day. So you could just buy £5 ticket and you'd turn up and there'd be a show.
Okay.
And you wouldn't know what it was. And she said, oh, do you want to curate one of these? Mm-hmm. And do a stand-up night and you host it. I was like, yeah, great. Only if everyone's called Tom. Ha, 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 ha. Hang on, that's definitely possible.
Yeah, sure.
So started Tomfoolery, mm-hmm. as it became known. And the first one had Crane, Baston, Parry, Neenan, Rosenthal and Stade. Which is quite a bill.
Great bunch of Toms. Good work.
What a bill. I'm sorry if I've forgotten anyone from that first one. Well, I think that's it. And I, you know, had to just host and do some stand-up. And I miss this quite a lot.
Yes.
And so I started doing Tomfoolery in London monthly, just so I would always have a gig.
So this is Tom. I mean, what is there to say about Tom? You can hear what a preposterous human being he is, and a very lovely one. Very, very funny guy. Do check out that the Penny Dreadfuls radio series. You can get hold of that illegally somewhere. I think that's probably fine to say at this stage. Don't ask me, though, for it, because I'm not in the habit of pimping out my stuff. Loads more coming from Tom. A really tricky one to edit this, because we talked for a long time. But nonetheless, these are the best bits, and I hope you enjoy them as much as I enjoyed having the conversation. Hello to Chris Hook in Sydney. I hope the Raw competition worked out. I was chatting with Luke Heggie here in Christchurch at the World Buskers Festival, where I'm currently performing. And so good luck to... Well, I think it's too late for good luck. I think he was in a heat of a competition last night. But, anyway, hello, Chris. That was a really badly managed shout-out. As well, we might imagine. All I have left to blurb to advertise. Thank you for your donations. I really appreciate those. You can go to comedianscomedian.com and click on the PayPal button. If you would like to, I'm in busking mode now. I'm up and running because I'm at the Buskers Festival. So take a moment to think about what this show is worth. Think of a figure, what this show is worth to you. Maybe that figure is a pound a show. Maybe that figure is a one-off payment of 20 quid. Whatever you like, get that figure in your head. Double it again. Double it a third time, there's no point being cheap, and get to comedianscomedian.com, click on the PayPal donate button, and you can name your price If you appreciate the work I'm doing here and the conversations I'm bringing you, then please feel free to ring in the new year by sending me your hard-earned cash. And I will use it to pay Nathan, my co-producer, and I'll use it to get some more music out of Dan Melrose, which, you know, I know some of you love the blurbs, but the stings, rather, but they will change before too long. And I will use that to travel, to go to exciting places, seek out new and interesting comedians, and then try and convince them they're unhappy. That is always the plan. And we'll be doing that with Tom Tuck in just a moment in the second part of the interview. Just quickly, we'd like to advertise on the 22nd of February, which is the final day of Dave's Leicester Comedy Festival. I'm going to be doing a live podcast. It's going to be Brendan Burns Part 2. Brendan, you may remember, I don't know if I ever said this on the show, but after we released the Brendan Burns podcast some 50 or so episodes ago, Brendan emailed me the night after it went out and said, right, and another thing. So this is Brendan's right of reply. We're going to get stuck into his unusual touring method that he's doing at the moment, and loads of other stuff besides. We might even have some time to talk about wrestling. But if you've got any questions, if the Brendan Burns podcast made you think anything, I know at least one fan of the show believes that that's the podcast which I became a man, that episode. But if you have any further questions for Brendan, chuck me an email, info@comedianscomedian.com, or you can tweet me @comcompod. I am perpetually rubbish at Twitter. I will try to get better. Coming up shortly, I've just recorded a fantastic podcast with Harley Breen, an Australian comic, a mammoth comedian with a phenomenally interesting backstory about his origin story, in fact, when he was sort of effectively in what he jokingly calls the cult, in a very religious Methodist upbringing where he wasn't allowed to go to dances or listen to pop music and stuff like that. And he's turned into a fascinating comedian, partially, I imagine, as a result of that. Really, I mean, vintage ComCom, though I say it myself. That one's coming up soon. And I don't know what order we'll do them in. I'm going to interview Ursula Carlson, fabulous South African comic who has newly made her home in New Zealand. And I'm doing a live one of those in Christchurch this weekend. But I imagine by the time you hear this, it will be too late for you to attend. So that will be coming out soon. We've got Harley Breen in the can. We've got Andrew O'Neill in the can. I've been resolving some sound issues with that one, and I think we're done. So those ones will come out over the next 3 weeks whilst I enjoy a lovely holiday here in New Zealand. Ladies and gentlemen, that's it for now. No, it isn't, Stu. Finish advertising the Brendan Burns Part 2 ComCom Pod, which is going to be live at 2:15 p.m. on Sunday, the 22nd of February, under the auspices of Heroes at LCB Depot. This is another Bob Slayer venture under the Heroes of Comedy title. So the room is the Light Box, and I've been asked to also mention Grey's Cafe in my press release, of which this is a sort of a one. Very exciting news about Edinburgh coming up soon, but I won't blab that just yet. And that is all the stuff. If you want to come and see me at Dave's Leicester Comedy Festival, you can search ComCom Pod. Or, you know, probably best to search Stuart Goldsmith at DLCF, and they'll have an online brochure available now, as well as the print version. And I will be doing a new work in progress show. I believe I've called it Stick to Your Guns. That may not turn out to be the final name of the show. As you will hear over the next few podcasts that I've recorded, I will be being more than usually open with my guests about my own fear that I've run out and have nothing left to say. So let's see if by the 22nd of February I could have thought of anything. It's very much that time of year at the moment. So that is all for now. I promise I will come up with more funny stuff. So come and see my show on the 22nd at, let's call it 7 p.m. Your Google is as good as mine. Now let's get back to Tom.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Fuck.
by other stand-ups? Are you a fan
a massive
of
stand-up nerd.
Stand-ups?
Yeah.
Because it's always seemed to me that your stand-up has been... Like, there's something that sets it apart from... And I don't know, to say it sets apart from something is to sort of suggest that there is a mean, you know, a standard way of doing stand-up. But there is something unusual about what you do. And I wonder whether it's to do with your persona. Now, we mentioned before your persona, you as described by yourself.
Well, no, it was that...
It was that car journey, wasn't it? Carly, yes, that was lovely. Yes, we were talking about who we were, and I was saying I have difficulty because I don't really know who I am, I don't know how I come across. Was it you? I think it was
me.
It was you.
It was me.
I turned around
and said, you were driving, weren't you?
No, Carly was driving.
I turned back to you and said, well, Stu, you're a dad without kids.
Yeah, that's it. It's perfectly obvious you're a dad with no kids.
I was annoyed about how I come across as posher than I am.
Yes.
And you said, well, you just got to try and embrace that. I still haven't figured that out. I still don't have an opening. I don't have the start. I mean, my best opening that I've got is I have to walk on with a drink.
Yeah.
And say, I should point out that this is a prop. It's my third prop of the day.
Okay.
Ah, prop comedy. And that sort of sets it up in the best. That's the best I've got so far.
Okay. Now... It seems to me
it's drunken barroom philosopher.
What? Yes, exactly. Now this is.
But Dylan Moran is the nearest thing, I think.
Yes.
That kind of even if it isn't, it sounds heavily written.
Is it a persona or is it a character? Is it that? I think that's what strikes me about your comedies. I don't know whether you are taking things away to reveal who you are on the inside, or whether you're adding elements to show us a character that you have created. Because I don't know how much of you, how much of your own self, you're very bluff, you're like a sort of micro Brian Blessed sometimes, you know, you've got those sort of elements. And I don't know how many of those are real and how many of those are things that you put on in order to get on with people.
When I went back to doing stand-up after however many years not doing it, probably... 6 or something, I realised the reason I'd stopped doing it is because everything I did was completely and utterly contrived. Even now, I'm looking back at one of the pieces of material, I'm reworking one of the pieces of material, but it never worked back then because it was so contrived. And I thought, I'm never going to do something that isn't true. Now, the definition of truth there is a little... elastic, because you can be. It is only through fiction that fact can be made instructive. George Bernard Shaw. So I think I am putting things on to show you me.
Are you? When you quote George Bernard Shaw, do you know what I mean? That seems in keeping with the persona that you've invented. I don't think it's you.
I don't know whether there is a me.
Go on.
My everything about me is constructed.
Yes.
It all is. I'm only this English because I was at an American school and you react, you know, you negatively define.
You define yourself by who you are?
Yeah.
So you became more English. So your parents don't talk with your sort of overtly plummy English voice?
No.
So your accent, the way you talk, is a construction of your youth. In the same way as... And people, there's no shame in that.
So,
I mean,
like over Christmas, my Leeds accent came back. When I hang out with pappies, because all my family are for wolves, I have a wolves accent.
For non-UK listeners.
Wolverhampton.
My family are from wolves.
If ever I try and do a Brummie accent to someone from Birmingham, they go... No, that's from Wolves, mate.
Yeah, yeah.
No, you can't do a Birmingham accent. You can only do a Wolves accent.
So...
And if I hang out with pappies, my accent goes Wolves. It's just I went to Edinburgh, and that is full of poshos. So that's the one that's been sort of rolled over most.
Okay. But so the accent is a facet of it. But for your stand-up, when you're telling stories, true stories that have happened in your life, and you're depicting, you're describing true heartbreak and true emotion, does it help the communication of those ideas for you to have a constructed persona?
It certainly did in the first show, the Disney show, because the subject was so outré, it needed quite a simplistic avatar to give it. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if I was necessarily thinking that through at the time, or that just sort of it seemed to be the best way to do it as a theatrical show. Like, I had to do it with a jacket. I had to have that jacket on.
Okay.
And I had a costume for that show.
Yes.
This isn't my... I wrote down things that I wanted to say to you, I think. Was it... It's that's it, yeah. The difference between being a comic and being a comedian. I'd love to be a comic, but I'm a comedian.
What do you mean those two terms to mean? Because for some people they're interchangeable. I don't know.
I don't think they are. A comic is someone who couldn't do anything else.
Yes. Okay.
Other than get up and be themselves.
Okay.
So Patrice O'Neill. Who else is a comic? Do we have any amazing comics in this country? It's an American thing. Mike Wilmot.
Yeah. Sure.
And a comedian is Stuart Lee.
Okay. What, because there's more... Because it's intellectual rather than instinctive? Is that the...
Yeah, possibly, but, like, I don't think you have a choice about which one of those you are.
That's... Yeah, I agree. I'm not entirely sure on your definition of the terms, but as it pertains to you, and that's what we're talking about, I want to keep this specific to you, you're saying that what... When I interviewed Stephen Grant, he said, I'm not a natural comedian.
Yeah.
Is that what you mean?
Yeah. So comic would be a natural comedian.
I understand what you mean. Okay.
Yeah.
So as it pertains to you, you feel that you are not natural. That you're not one of those funny bones guys.
No, I think I'm naturally funny. I'm not a natural stand-up.
Okay. Okay. And yet you want to be a stand-up. You are becoming, you are a stand-up and you are becoming a circuit stand-up. So the work is all there. So what is it that's different in you on stage? What are you still striving for on stage that you're not currently attaining?
I don't think I am as emotionally honest as I could be.
Okay. So in the sphere of what we've been talking about the last 10 minutes or so, and I will...
Can we have a wee break?
Yeah, by all means. Yes. I'll have a think. We'll leave that running.
Where is we?
It's just behind you, on the right.
Thanks.
For the benefit of the listener, Tom is going to the toilets to cut his wrists. I think when I saw your straight to DVD show, I found it frustrating in some ways. I laughed a lot. It was very funny. The ending was beautiful, and the things you were saying were all funny things. But I was frustrated because I felt like you were giving me a version. You weren't giving me your true self. And I think for me, now there is, obviously, like, Milton Jones isn't giving us his true self. He's still a stand-up.
I was thinking about, I've just thought about Milton in those terms, because he's a comedian. Like,
yes.
He's not a comic.
Okay. But I was frustrated because I was going, you, in you, somewhere, there is the real you. And I felt like you were, I feel now, like you are trying to let that you out. But you're tripping over the obstacles that you're putting in between and your actual, honest, real self.
Yeah. Problem was, the Disney show had to be done like that, I think.
By all means.
And then, so, yeah, I've been trying... just trying to get better at being a stand-up since. But that show needs to be like that.
Sure. And I should say as well, you mentioned before we started here, you are one of the earliest and most staunch supporters of this podcast, which is why I'm going extra hard on you.
No, absolutely fine.
So when I saw the square root of -1 mm-hmm. at Edinburgh Just Gone, again, there seems to me to be a kind of manneredness, which I suppose the word for that is a manner. There is an affectation in what you're doing, and I suppose it does mirror very accurately the affectations of your daily life. I mean, you are for the benefit of those who can't see you, and I'll take a picture.
You're
dressed, you're dressed like sort of Doctor Who. You know what I mean?
It's the nicest thing Humphrey's ever said to me. Is
what was that?
Of all the people I know, Tom, you'd be the best Doctor Who.
Absolutely. And I recognise that in myself of like wanting to dress weird, provoke a reaction from people, prove to people that I'm different and strange and stuff like that.
But that's the thing about me that's probably truest. Like I've always like down like from aged 12, like I was wearing ludicrous hats. Like,
does that mean it's true, or it just means it's a lie you've been telling for a long time?
Truest. It's a grayscale. Like maybe it is a lie I've been telling for the longest, but that's all I've got.
Well, no, it isn't all you've got. What you have got is the same as any of us have. You have a real self. It's like there's a now. Far be it from me.
I mean, but that is a quite, if you'll have to dip into philosophy, quite a large metaphysical claim.
Okay, it is. Let me make this claim then. My instinct is that there is a real you that doesn't have all these mannerisms. And that I'm gonna slam it out there. I think your stand-up would be better and more successful. Which isn't to say it's not successful at all. This is what I want to see from you, and it's a completely subjective value judgment. I feel like I want the real you. Come on, where are you? I mentioned this on a show.
I don't know if it came across, but that was the point of this year's show, was trying to examine that and trying to...
Yes, intellectually examined that. You didn't give it to us. You described the issues with it.
I didn't tell anyone that point because you can't tell someone
you
something.
You have to show, don't tell, absolutely, yes. But you see, I mean, that was like the theme of the show, but the issue of you on stage and how you relate to us, I just feel like there are... I'm asking is, do you agree that there are barriers in between you and an audience, and those barriers are of your own making? Because I think that's true of all comics. It's certainly true of me, that we're all of us trying to get out there and be as honest as we can.
I'm struggling at the moment with it. Very much. Like, the Square of Mind show would have been better with that intellectual structure if the stand-up had been... more emotional, more brutally honest stand-up.
I agree, absolutely.
I don't want to give up my intellectual fancies.
No. Do you say flouncings?
Fancies.
Fancies, but either are good.
I admire that when I see in shows. I think about those things quite a lot. Like Stuart Lee's... one where the whole like half an hour is essentially writing a joke that Joe Pasquale couldn't steal.
Yes,
and that's it's a big intellectual concept, and I think that's probably one of the best shows anyone's ever done. because of that, I do wish that the stand up in between was, you know, Patrice or
yes. Yes, because you are struggling with the tension between the lofty philosophical ideas and the earthy, actually real stand-up. And that is, let's face it, an incredibly big ask.
Yeah. Yeah.
This seems like it'll be a good time to talk about the Alternative Comedy Memorial Society, hereafter referred to as ACMS.
Yeah. It used to be called the Alternative Comedy Memorial Society... Memorial Society, brackets, or the Captain Planet Repertory Theatre Company, because that was the name I wanted to give it. Luke gave it the name ACMS.
I think Luke was right to give it that name. Just describe to us briefly what this is, and then we'll draw it back into the conversation.
The ACMS is a mixed bill comedy night that John Nick Roberts and I started with a board of performers and guest spots. But we sort of try and inculcate into our audience an attitude that people are going to try stuff and it might not work. Why not? Let's all have a good time anyway.
Yes, and not only that. I mean, the same could be The way you describe that, it sounds like any other night where people are trying new stuff, but it's nothing like that, is it?
No,
it's...
you can't. If you do straight stand-up, people just look at you.
Yes. So you have kind of fostered, you've kind of cultivated an audience of people who demand incredible risk-taking and nonsense and...
Well, no, not incredible. Like, Josie can get up there, because she's one of the board. She can get up there and just do stand-up.
Okay.
They'll take it from Josie. They'll take it from Bridget.
Josie Long, Bridget Christie. Yeah. I'm just trying to be mindful of non-UK listeners.
Oh, well, yeah. But you've had them both on, so they shouldn't listen to them.
Thank you. I totally agree. Yeah.
In fact, the shows recently have got quite sausage heavy because all the women on the board have got too bloody successful.
Okay.
Izzy Sutty, who hasn't done it in ages.
Yes.
Of course, she just had a baby, so...
But she can be forgiven.
Yeah.
One of the key motifs of the evening is after each
act, Luke and I will run on and shout, "A failure!" And the audience have to shout back, "A noble failure!" And that's probably the most illustrative thing you can say about the night.
Yes, gotcha. And
and you still haven't smashed those plates.
No, I haven't. I have 400 biscuitware, which means unfired plates, that I drove to Stoke to go and get in order to recreate an obscure French circus routine from the 1800s, about which I can find absolutely no mention online. So if anyone has heard of Les Cent Assiettes, the 100 plates, please email me. I'd love to know if anyone knows anything
and
about
you
it.
You pulled out because of the TV show.
Which one?
The stand-up-y one.
Oh, yes. Yes.
Whatever it was called.
Yes, whatever it was called. So, no, I haven't done it. And... I think, if I'm totally honest, part of it was realizing that these plates were going to kill someone because they were far heavier than I'd anticipated. And part of it was because I've been to see it twice. And although I enjoyed it both times, it did for me... Do you think the accusation could be levelled at it? And this is me putting myself in... There's Alfie caught me doing the other day, putting me into a more general thing rather than levelling this accusation myself... I mean, it's kind of like a hothouse of really exciting artistic ideas and stuff like that. And is it also at the same time a kind of cliquey, sixth formery, self-congratulatory experience? Yeah. Do you think that's fair?
Yeah, kind of. But the audience are part of that clique. And I don't see a problem.
Could you
I mean, I can't do any stand-up there.
Okay. Why is that?
Not weird enough. I can do... If I come up with a weird idea, I can do it.
Yes.
But Luke can do his, like, bits that will go into his show. Bridget wrote her entire show, the one, on stage, or, like, and typed it up that day and came out with it.
Mm.
And so, like, 10-minute chunks were just debuted on stage at ACMS. I'm very proud of that.
Yes.
Of things that have, you know...
What are some of the most outlandish things that have happened there?
usually Ben Targe. when we inducted Ben onto the board, we were doing it in... You know, the Arcola had a tent for a while, sort of big top.
I didn't know that.
We had all the board standing... lit, looking at Ben, who was lying on the ground in a overalls, and then he was painted with a trombone. So, like, a roller attached to a trombone was being played and just painted over his face. And, you know it's like, you know, Munnery says the intersection of art and comedy. It's not really either.
Yeah. Okay.
He does it as a joke, but, you know.
Yeah. And so you can't do your stand-up there, you said?
Not
like really. You host it, drunk, often.
I play far, far drunker than I am.
I'm relieved to hear that. I was going...
Sometimes I am.
I was considering opening this interview by going, "So, Tom, are you an alcoholic?"
No, because that isn't a thing.
Isn't it? Is it not?
No, just like Alfie was saying about bipolar.
Really?
Yeah, it's not a thing. Neither of them are things. They're helpful umbrella descriptions.
Why do you believe that? Let's stick with alcoholism specifically.
Did I not do that bit when you saw Scrooge minus one?
Maybe. Remind me.
Well, I didn't do it every time.
Okay.
Because it depended when it came up. It's not a disease in the same way that tuberculosis is a disease.
Understood.
If someone says, I am an alcoholic, they mean one of three things. And this is, I did this as material.
Yes, I remember.
Go on. Do believe it to be 100% true. They either mean I'm physically addicted to alcohol. Most of them do not mean that.
Okay.
They mean B, there are noises in my head, and if I pour alcohol on them, it helps.
Okay.
Or generally they mean C,
just pour
I'm a bit of a cunt.
Okay.
And if you, by asking, am I an alcoholic, do you mean, am I a bit of a cunt? Yes. I'm a bit of a cunt.
Now, I'm just thinking, I wouldn't have let Alfie get away with that, and I'm not going to let you get away with it. This is conversational shtick.
Well, yeah, that was a bit of material, but I genuinely, I don't think dyslexia is a thing either.
You don't think dyslexia is a thing? Are you dyslexic?
No. Certainly not in the way that, like, because I listened to Alfie's yesterday.
Yes.
Like Alfie, I am rigorously obsessed with truth.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fine if you want to call something alcoholism in someone else's life or your own life, specifically your own life. You say, I am an alcoholic. If that helps you get through the day and then that helps you get through the week, then that helps you get through the month, fine. But don't call me one and expect me to believe it's true. It's not a real thing.
I mean,
It's a description of... it's a description of behaviours.
Okay.
It is not philosophically rigorous to say it is a thing. It's just not. You know, in the same way that, this was in the show, but it isn't really comedy, a day is a thing because the sun goes up, the sun goes down. A month is roughly a thing because of the cycle of the moon. A year is a thing because of the going around the earth, going around the sun. A week doesn't exist. Like, we just have divided things. Okay, it helps us get through the day, and its meaning is use in that sense. But, Wittgenstein. But with meaning is use, most people have such vague ideas of the word alcoholism that they're not talking about what they think they're talking about. What they're talking about doesn't exist. This whole thing, oh, it's a disease. It's bollocks. It isn't.
Are you angry?
Quite.
Why are you angry?
Because I get very frustrated with vagueness and untruth.
Why?
I did a philosophy degree and I really liked it. I don't know.
It seems odd to me. I totally understood your point. That's fascinating that a week isn't a thing that exists. But you did seem very angry about it. I would suggest that...
I'm being defensive.
Maybe. Why are you being defensive?
Possibly. I drink too much. But I'm not an alcoholic.
What I was going to say was, it isn't a thing. I would suggest that this sounds like someone who's been accused a lot of alcoholism
yes.
whilst drinking a lot.
Yeah.
Okay.
I drink too much.
Why do you drink too much?
Refer you to the Bill Hicks thing about smoking. They've proven that if you give up smoking, you have a prolonged life. What no one has proved is that a prolonged life is a good thing.
Are you... So what you're alluding to there is...
I spent all my money on drink and the rest I wasted.
Yeah, I want to hear what you think of it.
Well, that's just genuine. I think, why not? Like, if you're doing something you haven't got anything to do later, pour drink on it, it'll be more fun. No, any drug.
do you think...
The legal one and the socially acceptable one.
Yes. Are you unhappy? Is that where this comes from?
Quite possibly.
Think, what might you be unhappy about that you would want to pour drink on things? I mean, you can accept that whether or not alcoholism exists, whether or not it's philosophically rigorous, there is presumably
if someone wants to say that I drink too much, then I want the predicate of that idea. What do you want me to do better? There are people who've said specifically to me, that's not okay because of this. And I go, okay, I'm not going to do that again. And I, but just blanket, don't drink as much. The only reason I can think to myself why I probably should is I want to lose some weight. Like, that for me is... makes sense.
Absolutely. So, and I'm not denying your right to drink as much as you want, absolutely, but it does seem to me that there is defensiveness in there, and that suggests anger. And what is it that you're angry about? What you were alluding to there with the sort of various kind of aphorisms about alcohol consumption.
Anti-aphorisms, but you know, I'm fine. A pedant.
But what you're alluding to is, I mean, it seemed to me, is that, hey, listen... life isn't so great anyway. Why don't we get drunk? Because life's a horrible place, or it doesn't end well. Or that is that what you meant? Is that what you're?
No. Just
you said it ends and it ends.
No one has proved that prolonged life is a good thing.
No one's. Yeah, exactly. That prolonged life is a good thing. So that suggests a sort of willful self-destruction.
Maybe, but I think I meant it as a kind of have fun now.
Yes, okay. We might sort of infer that that's quite a... that it's a way of saying have fun now that contains a fairly sort of self-destructive streak.
Perhaps.
Do you see yourself as a self-destructive person?
Yeah, probably.
Can we get into why? Can we get into this? Because
I haven't been able to.
That's okay. We've got infinite time and we don't need to post it all. But are you angry or unhappy in a way that you don't talk about on stage?
Not angry, I don't think. Possibly unhappy, but I think there's some sort of well of unhappiness that I haven't figured out yet.
That seems like it might be right. So
it's not that I'm not trying, I just don't.
What kind of trying is that? Have you ever had therapy? Have you ever had a counsellor, anything like that?
No.
Or have you just thought about it yourself and tried to get to the bottom
of
it?
No, but I'm reasonably suspicious of most of it.
Yes. That's a really difficult combination. I know people like...
Because of the philosophical background, like, I want to know what... like, who the person reads and...
yes.
Studied, you know.
Yes.
If
which also, at the same time, conveniently, and I don't mean to make light of it, but that also allows you to not get any help.
I've been researching.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm meeting someone on Sunday to talk about their experiences of therapy.
Okay.
And maybe try and...
I don't want to go too deep in this.
No, it's fine. Well, no, to be fair, if you listen to this... I'm not specifically meeting him to talk about that. I'm meeting to hang out, but I'm going to... I have texted him about it before.
Let's bring it back to what we know about, which is your performance. Do you think that comedy helps you with some of the unhappiness that you feel or might feel?
I don't think so.
What does comedy help you with?
I don't think it helps me.
Does it just keep you busy?
I need to be performing.
Why? How does it serve you? What do you get from performing? I mean, in its most basic, obvious terms. The terms to you which are bloody obvious, what are those?
It's just what I do.
You'd be bored, you'd be lonely, you'd be...
insufferable without it.
I mean, you're fairly insufferable already.
Honk.
Because what?
I think it's what I'm good at, so I should be doing it.
Yes, but it's perfectly reasonable. Absolutely. You are very good at it. You're a very natural...
But I think that's or your calling or the Aristotelian... And it was Aristotle for the golden mean that Alfie was talking about. It was Aristotle. Also, that is complete bollocks in terms of moral philosophy. But
I don't want to get too meta on this.
Fuck you, Alfie.
These have to be standalone episodes.
Bertrand Russell said, no. the idea of eudaimonia, a thing's purpose is what makes it flourish.
Okay. Okay. Yes.
So and that's what you should do. I mean, it's a problematic idea because that, you know, technically that means that women should have children.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
But yeah. I can't see many other purposes for me.
Yes, that's interesting. Purpose, that's something I don't often talk about on this show. That's a good point. I feel my purpose is to perform, and I rail against it and have issues with it based around that story that I'm telling myself. I go, okay, that's it. I've decided that this is my purpose, and now sometimes I feel like I'm not very good at my purpose, and that feels far worse than if I found out I'm not very good at painting.
Mm. Well, it's performance, and I think a lot of people... needlessly carve it up. And obviously we need to carve things up, otherwise it's difficult to understand such a large spectrum of thing as performance.
Mm-hmm.
But I think any time that you stand on stage, in any format, whether it's acting, lecturing, stand-up, being in a band, it's all, you know, it's all part of the same thing. There are many gradations in between all of these. And, like, that, I need to do some of that. So I need to do something in that. Or be a dad.
Or be a dad.
Yeah. That might be the sadness.
Yeah.
Quite possibly. Well, I mean, that's why that was the punchline. That's inverted commas on the punchline of the Disney show, wasn't it?
Yes. Yes. Do you think your this is maybe moving into different territory here? But do you think that your lifestyle is compatible with parenthood? I'm not saying it isn't. I'm just saying I have worries about my lifestyle as a performer and a person that made a lot of decisions about his purpose with a view to just going out and having fun and feeling like myself and flourishing. And
I'm
going
quite
all
free in the day.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what I come back to, yeah.
You know, you just, like any parents, you'd split the time, but I'm quite free in the day. So.
Mm. Let's have babies and go and take them down the park and...
Mm.
Get drunk.
Let's have gabies without being gay.
Do you read your reviews?
Yeah.
How do you read your reviews?
I turned it into a game.
Brilliant. Tell me about the game.
You tweet a link to every review with a quote, which is the silliest thing you could possibly pull out of the review,
okay,
and the number of stars. So... not a rip-off. 3 stars. Link to the Chortle review.
Lovely.
The full sentence is, there are shades of Stuart Lee, but it's clearly not a rip-off.
Okay.
But not a rip-off is the silliest thing I could pull out of context.
Yes, particularly in that sentence where one, you know, someone not playing the game would pull shades of Stuart Lee.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Innately solipsistic.
Yes.
Or, his hair is an ever-moving objet d'art.
Now, is this...
Five stars.
That's nice. Does playing that game demonstrate to the wider world that reviews are simply things for me to toy with because they're meaningless? Or does it... That's what it seems to reflect to me. And is that an honest appraisal of your view about reviews? Or is it a defence mechanism?
No, I don't think it's a defence mechanism. Because I've always read all the reviews. And even Dreadfuls, I always like to know when the reviews were in. The others too. Didn't want to know at all, so like Steve or Idle would come up to me and tell me who was in that day. I'm relatively philosophical about them. You know, if something's badly written, I can discount all of their opinions. if it's well written, I'll go, huh. I'll try and grapple and see if they've got a point. But I've no problem with them. Like, nothing's really smashed me.
Okay.
I think it'll manage to keep our independent one from 2009 away from us. I think that might have hurt me.
Right. Why on
ones to watch, just not this year.
Oh God. That's an oddly passive aggressive thing to say.
And they didn't publish a review from the year before, which is presumably what they're referring to. Like,
yeah.
But in general, like I get 3 and 4 stars from pretty much everybody for my stand-up. One reviewer found me this year. Bastards.
Yes, I read that. I saw that.
Bastards! One found me on the last day. It wasn't for them. I was doing the underground experiment of this high-concept, stupid show, handmade flyers, who's coming. I was getting about 30 people, 40 people a day. Bloody reviewer. 1 4 review, dropped a card in the bucket.
What are you doing next year?
Probably not a new stand-up show. Not 100% sure. We'll be doing ACMS, I think. Hopefully back in the Kitson slot at the stand. Could be a lot of fun there 2 years ago. Mm-hmm. Hopefully a play. I need to 100% find I can get the rights for it. I did it 10 years ago.
What's the play?
Scaramouche Jones.
Oh, wow. That's a one man. That's a. Wow. I've never seen it. I've seen. It's like a guy being a clown for various ages.
It's a 100 year old clown telling the story of his life, which mirrors the story of the first half of the 20th century.
I will certainly come and see that. I'd love to see
it. But
that.
I did it at the Fringe in 2005.
Okay.
So the idea would be to do it every 10 years until I'm dead, which is sort of a long scale fun joke.
Do you? It's funny. I can hear how much that tickles you, and I can hear throughout this conversation.
But it's going to be interesting.
Absolutely, yes. But I want to make a different point, which is that I can hear how much it tickles you to have sort of interestingly intellectual approaches, like the combination of the intellectual and the sort of the beast of the fringe, you know, and the kind of the sweat and the people wandering around and all the rest of it. I can hear how much that's you enjoy that. Do you feel like you are part of the fringe? Do you feel like you're part of a gang in the fringe of the people you came up with and the...
No, I feel like I'm part of the fringe. I don't feel like the fringe, like not like part of the comedy community in the fringe or part of the thing. Part of the fringe first. Fringe comes first.
Are you asking me to clarify what I said or is that your answer?
No, that's my answer. The fringe comes first, yeah. The this many creative people in this city trying to make something good. It's astonishing.
Do you feel part of the comedy community?
Just about. Why? Because I didn't come up with I didn't have to do the open mics. So I didn't. I did maybe one in London. Screw that. Never doing that again.
In times like this, I feel like I should add a note to, if there are open micers listening to this, I mean, take that advice by all means.
Don't do it.
Decide not to bother.
Don't do it. Do something good.
Let's end with...
Just do something good instead.
Let's end with that. Let's end with, what's your advice for a new comic of any ilk? What advice would you give to her? And I'm often, it's obviously very comic-centric, or comedian-centric in your terms, but what's your advice to a creative person that wants to make a living from their art? What's the single most important thing that you've learned? And it has to be your own words, not a quote.
It's an aphorism, but it's my own words. To walk the line, sometimes you have to fall the wrong side.
To walk the line, sometimes you have to fall on the wrong side of it. Okay. So what does that mean? Don't feel bad when you get it wrong.
Yeah.
Because at least you tried.
Yeah, exactly. Try. Try and do something good. Try and eat something. Not, don't try and do what you think you're supposed to. Try and make a quality thing. Then hopefully someone might like it.
Thanks, Tom.
No worries.
So that was Tom. I mean, he's just an absolute pleasure to talk to and a really fascinating comic voice and a really fascinating person. And he was very candid with me, as I know you like it when I get them to be all candid. And I think ever since the Alfie Brown podcast when he said... it was unfair because I was going much harder on him. I've decided if you're a listener to the show and you're coming on the show, the gloves are off. So that's all for now. Tweet me at ComCom Pod. You can also follow at Stu Goldsmith if you'd like to hear me occasionally asking how best to do the odd DIY question, the odd DIY challenge. You can email me info@comedianscomedian.com if you have any questions or suggestions for future guests. There's an ever-growing list which basically contains all comedians. So please contribute to that, info@comedianscomedian.com. And if you would like to donate to the show, please rest assured my guests never see a penny. You can go to comedianscomedian.com and click on the donate button. That, I think, will stay up there, even though we are going to be overhauling the website over the next few weeks and months. And I'm very, very excited about that. I've got my friend Homebrew is on the case. So we can expect good things from him, and we'll be genuinely overhauling the whole appearance of the site and the whole functionality. There's going to be some really exciting things coming up there. I'm rambling now. I'm allowed to ramble. I'm 3 days away from an epic 3 week holiday, and I'm just making sure I've got everything racked up and ready to go so that I need not lift a finger while I'm away. Speak to you soon.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.